My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You're on Team Human, conscious intervention in the machine. An active response by human beings working together, not against technology, but against the way technology can be used to disenfranchise, disempower, and disengage human beings from one another. No, techno-feudalism is not inevitable. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, the tech columnist just laid off by the LA Times and author of The One Device and the brand new book, Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech, Brian Merchant.
A lot of the very same instincts and very same sort of trajectories were established in those early days. The same inclinations of the people who were using technology in this very specific way, and that's to concentrate power and capital, ultimately.
Ryan will be sharing the lessons learned by the Luddites. Not an anti-technology movement at all, but a workers' rebellion against the way automation was used to crush the underclass. What do the Luddites have to tell us about the age of AI? Let's find out. It's time to intervene on behalf of people and all living things. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and we're all on Team Human. I've been getting a ton of calls from media outlets lately covering a recent highly circulated set of videos in which a few skateboarders and other San Francisco locals attack and then torch a driverless cab, an autonomous vehicle owned by Waymo, which is Google's robot car company. They wanted to speak with me as the author of the book Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus about the fact that people are now throwing skateboards at the Google car. But when I wrote Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, I wasn't arguing that we should attack technologies or the people who use them. I was lamenting at the way these potentially liberating technologies had been turned against people and places, and to the point where people and places were starting to react against them. Google originally was two college students taking down big, bad corporate Yahoo with a bottom-up algorithm. And because a few $1 billion a year of profit wasn't enough for its investors, they pivoted to an extractive company that made San Francisco unlivably expensive for the people who live there. Automation could be making our lives easier, but in the hands of these anti-social tech billionaires, they instead render us powerless. We can feel how these technologies are simply automating oppression and disenfranchisement. Once they don't need human workers anymore, we don't even have a means of resistance. What's a general strike in a world run by robots? That Waymo car feels like the precursor to a Waymo cop or robot replacement, only now it's defenseless. It's really just another version of replacement theory, which is why Steve Bannon and Alex Jones are now quoting my work. Even they get that there's something anti-human about all this. So no, I can't condone violence, even against stuff. I'm not into the how to blow up a pipeline justification for attacks on infrastructure, however heinous, because they're usually precursors to violence against other people. But there's something still like an expression of human agency in an attack like this. Yeah, it went viral because it's expressing a repressed agenda in popular culture. They're not acting on our behalf, but they are expressing a widely felt anxiety. These technologies are not our friends, at least not as currently deployed. So helping us think through all this today and maybe helping us feel a little bit less guilty about that sense of glee mixed in with the horror of watching a perfectly innocent robot car go up in flames, it's my pleasure to welcome the writer who, until last week, was tech columnist at the Los Angeles Times, laid off along with much of their in-house writing staff, and also the author of some of my favorite accounts of the impact of technology on society, including the great book, The One Device, which is about the secret history of the now ubiquitous iPhone, and his new book, Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. That's right, Brian Merchant. So, hey, Brian.
Hey, Douglas, how are you?
Good. It's good to see you. You look freshly showered or something. You look clean.
Yeah. Well, you know, when it rains, it pours. So our shower's actually clogged up and we're waiting on the landlord to respond to that. So I had a nice bath, a nice luxury, newly unemployed person bath where I just kind of sat in the bath and marinated for a while.
Wow. Nice. So you're an unemployed renter in an increasingly feudalist nation.
That I am.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's talk about that first. So the LA Times, I always loved the LA Times. I mean, not everything about it, but I loved that it still had a working book review section. And it had, what's her
name?
Not
anymore.
That woman in the op-ed page there, the editorial page, is great. She was from the Times op-ed page originally. I forgot her name now, but the really quality, I mean, they would call for... Oh, would you write 1,500 words on why this, you know, media monopoly is going to be a problem? And then, like, read it and write comments and questions back? You know what I mean? It was like, I remember from the early 90s, these editors who would read the stuff that you wrote and make comments about it, and you'd work with them.
Yeah, like in the way it's supposed to, that like sort of like platonic ideal of the, my first interaction with the LA Times was when my first book came out, which was about the iPhone, and
right.
I did an op-ed.
Which is a great, I mean, that's if you don't even read the book, just listen to the title, The One Device, and you flash back to Steve Jobs curling over that thing, and it's just the perfect encapsulation of what that one device has done, you know?
Yeah, that was the intent, you know. Yeah. It was the first thing we thought to call it, and it was a placeholder. We thought we'd find something like, I don't know, more like sexy or evocative, but it just stuck because it was the most sort of just comprehensive.
Yeah.
But anyways, yeah. So it was great. Like it was the kind of thing where I think my editor was Julia Turner, who's now the I think the one of the editors left after this bloodbath. Still editing the paper, but like, yeah, she would call and she like, I just had some ideas about this. What do you think about this? And then she's like making the notes over the phone. And I was like, wow, this is like old school, sort of really plugged in, really caring about what's actually going to be printed. And that was my relationship with my editor who is also gone in these layoffs. Jeff Bercovici, who is the editing the business page. Yeah.
But and still, it feels better if you're going to be canned that the person who's canning you got canned too at the same time. At least, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's not you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you hate to wish that on anybody, especially like an editor you're fond of. But yeah, if the whole department's being cleaved off and floating into the sea, it reflects, less personally on you. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was just because of that recent thing where they realized they were losing all this money. I guess.
You know, it's still a real mystery. I mean, that's one of the great sort of paradoxes, maybe is a gentle word to call it, about like newsroom management, is that there's no transparency. We don't know what's going on. You know, you think like you're in the business of information gathering and being truthful and honest and trying to present the public with and we can't even get that from our own management. So it's really just a really hazy, ambiguous sort of massive chaos where, you know, the lead editor left and it sure looks like he was pushed out the door. And then shortly after, two of his lieutenants left, and whether or not they've left because of him or were pushed out, who knows? We don't even know who's firing us, who made the decisions for the layoffs. It's all just...
What if it's like Chinese hackers firing you and not even...
Yeah, it wasn't even supposed to happen.
I know.
Yeah.
But I know what you mean, though. I mean, I'm experiencing a similar thing at Queens College, at CUNY. You know, they're doing these draconian budget cuts, and people who thought they were starting class teaching next week in contracted positions were let go at the last minute. You know, their health insurance and everything's gone. And there's this... And I know people write maybe more directly about it than you know, like Alyssa Cord and Astra Taylor, you know, about this widespread precarity that so many of us are experiencing in the work that we do, where the things that we're incentivized to do, like what you were doing, you're going to write great pieces about technology that get lots and lots of hits. I mean, if you look at your metrics, you're getting the 2 million reads rather than the 102,000 reads. You know, it's like I'm doing all the things that I've been contracted to do at a level beyond what you're asking me, hitting the actual metrics that you want me to hit. And that, when that isn't good enough, then what, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what's so grim about it. I mean, there was this this like sports writer who kind of went viral in the wrong way this year, Perlman or something. I wasn't familiar with him before this, but he said, you know, like if you really want to hang in there, it's tough out there, I know, but what you got to do is you got to start the Substack, you got to start the, you know, blog. You got, if you're a young journal, you know, say I'm going to do a podcast too. I'm going to do all this stuff. And people rightfully sort of revolted against that mindset because, yeah, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. You know, I just published a book that has gotten, you know, not to like blow my own horn or anything, but got a bunch of accolades like best book of the year in Wired and blah, 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 blah. Like hitting, not resting on my laurels, turning a piece out every week. Like you said, getting good audience. I have. And then like, it doesn't matter. It does not matter. They fired Susie Exposito, who's just as all-star as you can get, covering Latin culture and music and just a real superstar in the field. Boom, she's gone. There's no rhyme or reason. You cannot produce enough to satiate the just the fickle whims of the billionaire that you're laboring for.
Right, I realized that. Right, when I was kind of let go from Medium as one of their official star writers or whatever, people paid writers, I guess would be the better way to say it. I kind of realized that you can't, it's like my pace of writing doesn't match the pace of the internet. You know, it's like shoveling coal into a friggin' railroad engine. You know, it's like, how much do I have to produce? I'm now supposed to do two pieces a week or something?
Even if you did, they would still have Cory Doctorow. There is no human alive that is more productive than Cory Doctorow in terms of written output. And he was at the same Medium program, I think, too. Yeah. I think we all briefly overlapped there because I worked at Medium, too. Mm. And that wasn't enough to save him either. The business model changed, whatever changed.
Oh, really? Good. You know, I'm not good for Corey, but good because I was thinking, am I just getting too old and slow? Because I look at Corey and go, oh, so he could do a piece every other day and a book every other month. So do I need to somehow get there? Am I not turbocharged? Do I need better protein powder or psilocybin? You know, what do I need to do that? And I decided I just can't do it. So what? But the fact that he did it and still couldn't maintain the, so it's like, okay. So now, which brings me to this brilliant book and its theme, Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. Now, I'm one of those few people who knew that when you call me a Luddite, I say thank you, not fuck you, because Luddite doesn't mean anti-tech. Luddite means anti-tech that is bad for humans, basically. But this brilliant book, Blood in the Machine, is not just about the way big tech exploits humanity, but the way big tech dovetailed with capitalism. Yeah. Exploits humanity.
Yeah. I mean, it really was sort of in the gestational phases, this apparatus that we could call. I mean, some people have kind of taken issue with the fact that I call it big tech back then, but it's just, I mean, I hope it's read as sort of just kind of like, you know, a somewhat sly, you know, sort of winking just a mechanism that kind of allows us to kind of keep these two things loosely in mind. But that said, a lot of the very same instincts and very same sort of trajectories and were established in those early days. The same inclinations of the people who were using technology in this very specific way, and that's to concentrate power and capital ultimately by doing things that are not, you know, associated primarily with innovation necessarily, but more with exploitation,
right,
and being willing to sort of break down traditional structures, break down norms, cause some immiseration, cause some suffering, being willing to do all those things.
Right. Well, I mean, it's the chartered monopoly is really what made that possible. Because once you had chartered monopolies, you don't have to innovate anymore. You have a monopoly. So your focus, the way you're going to make more money, is no longer by competing effectively with competitors. It's going to be by how do I extract value more effectively and efficiently from the humans and resources.
Yep, and that's what this was from our early. I mean, it's a drive towards monopolization because all that they wanted to do. So just as like a quick backdrop, we're talking about the sort of the cloth making industry in England in the 1700s and early 1800s was by far the largest industrial industry. It was a non-agricultural source of work. There is hundreds and thousands of workers. It was sort of responsible for Britain's
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Sort of burgeoning economic might. So within this industry, you start to see, again, as you put it, sort of the early stages of we're inching towards capitalism and a capitalist reorganization, because we've got domestic economies, mostly domestic labor, where people are working in what's the cottage industries. They have their machines. It's technology. They're good at using technology. They're technologists because they work their machines, repair them, mod them to their liking, make them a little bit more efficient, all within the confines of their house. But you have just thousands and thousands of people doing this, working in the actual cottage industry. And the shift starts to come, yes, a little bit with people who realize that you can start to do what we would call automation today and automate some of these machines. But more so when people say, hey, well, if you get a lot of those machines that are doing some automating and you stack them, you know, on six stories of a building and hook it up to a water power, then you're cooking. Then you can really lean into the division of labor. Then you can really undercut on price. Then you can really, nobody's thinking about all the great, you know, improvements to mankind or technology. It's just you could produce more stuff cheaper. And the people that were doing that didn't care about communities that had grown up with this other mode of economic organization for decades and decades. We're talking like 200 years, an economy and a mode of life had been formed around this. So the people who were willing to disrupt all that, and disrupt really, I do think, is the operative term, become what I call the first tech titans. People like Richard Arkwright, who is remembered as the father of the factory and the patenter of the water frame that allows mass volumes of yarn to be spun. But two important caveats that apply today too. He didn't actually invent the thing. He kind of stole the ideas and patented it from but before somebody else could. He kind of ripped off his inventor, a la Steve Jobs and Wozniak, and kind of took the lion's share of the profits. And his chief innovation, you know, a la someone like Bezos today, was not that machine, but the fact that he's willing to put it into use, willing to create punishing conditions, and willing to have factories that are two-thirds child labor. So that's ultimately what sort of moves the needle and allows him to become one of the first sort of mega rich commoners. You know, he's not aristocracy. He grew up right. as a barbershop owner. So that part, you know, tracks. Like he, but the reason that he was able to do it wasn't because he had this brilliant spark. It's willing. He was willing to sort of corrode all these norms and standards. And the cloth workers who fought against that, which I'm sure we'll be talking about more, became the Luddites.
Right.
And yeah.
Now, these cloth workers weren't the original saboteurs, right? They didn't throw their shoes in the machine.
No. So the cloth workers tried for decades, really, and especially the first decade of the 1800s. Once they realized where all this was going, and that more and more shop owners were having to become factory owners, and were having to sort of compete on scale if they wanted to stay in business, they realized that these automating machinery were allowing the those factory owners to sort of reduce prices and undercut their wages, and sort of so they tried a bunch of stuff first. They fought, you know, there was, you know, machine breaking was kind of a tactic that always hung around in the background long before the Luddites came around. So if something was grievous enough, they sure would go, you know, it would happen.
But yeah, probably like the slaves in ancient Egypt were like sticking pebbles in the catapults or whatever, right?
Yeah, or you'd have a like sort of a visceral outbreak, you know, the spinning jenny, which was one of the very first sort of machines that sent the whole trajectory in motion when the inventor of that machine unveiled it. Yeah, people like just kind of ran in and smashed all his machines because they knew they knew what use it would be put to. They knew he was doing it not to sort of bestow unto the community and say, hey, how about we sort of ratchet up efficiency together? We can all sell more stuff. We'll figure out a way to sort of make this benefit. No, he was hoarding them. He was keeping his design secret in his house. And he sort of knew that he was going to try to commercialize this thing to profit personally. Right, but and that's what folks found so offensive.
None of these guys back then were thinking about anything like UBI. They weren't. I guess not. But you know what I mean? It's like, it's such an easy sell of like, you know, the same sell to the housewife of America, you know, oh, instead of washing clothes on this board, here's this machine and you'll push a button and throw your kids' stuff in there. And you're going to, I mean, that looked good. Shouldn't it have been the same? Hey, workers, look how much easier your life is going to be when you don't have to do this stuff.
Yeah, it was really interesting in terms of sort of the ideology that was attached to these different pursuits, because there wasn't as you alluded to earlier, there wasn't, you know, capitalism wasn't really fully formulated, much less understood. But Adam Smith's teachings about the division of labor, about sort of the virtues of pursuing profit in, you know, in an above board way, you know, was really taking a sort of flight with the elites of the time. So there was a subset, and the people that supported this most ardently sort of, you know, could at least justify what they were doing by this sort of economic dogma that was sort of the Smithian, you know, that his opponents would call them the disciples of Dr. A. Smith. And you see that in the Luddite letters, people opposing them because they're appealing to sort of the early sort of ideological strains of capitalism as sort of a justification for just running roughshod. Because no, you don't see it's decades until you see really earnest pitches made like that. You do see some, you know, there's Robert Owens, the mill owner, who's this fabulously wealthy businessman who makes his working conditions a little bit better in the factory, says we should provide education to everybody, we should do all this, we should build entire towns around the factory and then make everybody, like, he has this sort of collectivist, it's still very paternalistic, yeah. Like, he's still going to be the boss, but he wants everybody to do better, and he really goes on a decades-long campaign to try to make that.
And I thought Adam Smith was like that too, though, because he was all into sort of local businesses and, you know, land, labor, and capital, you know, all having an equal say at the table.
Anti-monopoly.
Yeah. So it's like if they were really reading Adam Smith, they wouldn't just want to exploit workers. They'd want to figure out, how do we make this work in a local economy?
Well, that's a funny thing, is early on, you just see how it's interpreted when it at these points when it really matters.
Right. They interpreted it like The Economist or Wired still interprets Adam Smith.
Yeah, and it's not, and that interpretation isn't necessarily playing out on the local level. Mostly, where it really matters is in Parliament, where you have this new sort of echelon. They called themselves New Tories. It was they were not supposed to be your grandpa's Tories, but they were the new conservatives who were sort of you know, more liberal on some social issues, you know, anti-slavery and things like that.
Right.
But they were embracing Adam Smith as a doctor, as an excuse to let well enough alone, to exercise laissez-faire.
Right.
That was the biggest thing. So when the cloth workers came and said, hey, we're getting killed out there because there's these capitalists that have machinery that they can just kind of be more productive than we can ever hope to be, and they're grinding our wages into the dust, we need something like a minimum wage. What do they point to? They point to Adam Smith. They point to these new influential sort of lawmakers who can then make the case for having no protection at all. And so over the course of that first decade of the 18th century, they try so hard. They come in and they have petitions signed by tens of thousands of people. They have data to back up what exactly is happening. And they want these really small sort of, they want a minimum wage. They want assurances that they won't be paid in truck or, you know, paid at the company store, that kind of thing.
Right.
They want it paid in goods. They want assurances. They want protections from fraudulent and sort of, you know, copy, you know, material that's sort of ripping them off. So
right,
and
they didn't have unions to do this yet, right?
And unions are outlawed. 1799 Combination Acts are on the books, which are kind of a response to, you know, right after the French Revolution, people in England were like, hey, maybe democracy is a good idea. So anything that had the whiff of democracy in the 1790s was stamped out. So you couldn't publish Tom Paine pamphlets, you couldn't have workers' organizations, and you couldn't unionize. They called them combinations at the time, and they were against the law.
And then, when did we get the blood?
The blood in the machine really starts churning in 1811. So after this whole process we've been talking about kind of culminates when in 1809, when Parliament says, okay, we've had it with you guys. We don't actually, you know what? We've made up our minds.
Fuck all y'all.
Yeah, exactly. Not only are we not going to add any new laws to the books to protect you, we're going to tear up the old ones. We're tearing out all the regulations that put rules in place on things like apprenticeship, on quality of cloth that, you know, at the time only human cloth makers could accomplish. They threw them all out and they said, you're on your own. You're literally on your own. And then we have a series of events like the trade blockade against Napoleon, a bad harvest, and all of a sudden people are literally going hungry in the streets. And 1811 is when the actual sort of uprising begins and in earnest. And, you know, it becomes an organized campaign to very targeted explicitly at sort of the productive machineries that are taking the jobs of the people. So it's a working class popular movement, you sort of in the style of Robin Hood, and it's organized under the banner of this apocryphal mythic figure, Ned Ludd, who is the, you know, he's got a giant hammer and he will smash the machinery of oppression. And people, you know, cheered him in the streets. They wrote folk songs about him. He was a hero. That's how bad things were, and that's how acutely this critique was felt among the mass
public.
And
did he have like a cartoon face, like, you know, like Guy Fawkes does, little masks and stuff?
It was before that you could really sort of mass produce a lot of
merch.
You know, stuff. So we don't. Merch. There's not as many logos. There is like the most famous. You know, one thing that the Luddites would do is. Sort of both as kind of like this, you know, transcendental or liberatory practice, and also in solidarity with all of the women who had lost their jobs to the previous rounds of automation. They would dress in drag. They would dress in women's clothes when they would go on these campaigns and parade through the streets with a hammer. And so that's probably the most enduring image, is like an art, but it's an artist's rendering of the Luddites, and it's like a giant man in a woman's clothing sort of like leading on his followers while a mill burns in the background, and you can find that one around. But yeah, no, at the time, not really. They're letters. It's all letters. So they sign them General Ludd or King Ludd. And they, you know, once the tactic starts in Nottingham, same neighborhood as Robin Hood, and once it proves successful, emulators, you know, crop up all over England, and it proves like a really effective tactic, because the factory owners are on their heels. They don't know if there is a real Ned Ludd, how many there are, is how organized is this whole thing. Like, it seems pretty threatening, right? Because factories are going up in flames and machines are being smashed.
So it's like anonymous, or something. They just don't know, right? You know.
They don't know.
So you're saying it was successful. I mean, obviously not to today, not successful for 200 years, but so the immediate success was what? The factory owners said, oh, we'll be nice to you now. We'll give you money. We'll stop using machines. I mean,
kind of immediately that was the response. So you really have this interesting moment where, again, if you think about how this is playing out, you have really a handful of a relative handful of the steeliest eyed, the hardest headed, who really do not give a shit, and they are willing to just sort of run roughshod over people's livelihoods. They don't care as long as it makes them a profit. Your classic caricature of, you know, the cigar chomping,
right,
you know, industrialist or tycoon. There's a handful of them, and a lot of other people are kind of dragged kicking and screaming into this. Merchants, small business owners going like, shit, we're getting our lunch eaten right now. We need to automate too. And it was actually, I detail in the book this point where there's like a real debate among sort of smaller operations. And some just say like, you know what? We see what's going on here, and we to us, this looks immoral. If we adopt automating machinery, it's literally taking the bread out of somebody else's mouth,
right,
and we're not going to do that.
Right.
So a lot of them,
but that'd be like, you know, like Dark Horse Comics or something deciding, oh, we're not going to use AI to draw our pictures. You know, even if whatever the big boys are going to go do that stuff, and Marvel, you know, movies, we're going to keep our little craftspeople alive.
Yeah. And some of them go out of business because it's just this, but it's a moral choice and it's hard. But a lot of them do automate, but then the Luddites rise up and they're so popular and they're making this critique that probably resonates with a lot of them too. So they say, okay, good. We have an excuse now. We'll wave the white flag. And in Nottingham, especially, they say, okay, boom, we'll restore the rates to what they were before all this cratering started happening. So they got they got an immediate raise. They got some protections. It only lasted about, you know, a year and a half, because you have those sort of, you know, the strongest and most aggressive factory owners did the opposite and dug their heels in, and they still had to compete with them. But so what you have is a respite. Basically, you have some immediate raises, you have an improvement in working conditions, some assurances, some districts it's more durable than others, and then as the campaign goes on, it gets most violent in Manchester and in Lancashire, where the cotton industry has taken root, and it's so explosive there that it does delay the introduction of some of this more famous automated machinery for years and years, and it gives the Luddites time, or it gives the cloth workers time to work on reforms and to actually get some protections in place.
But are the Schumpeter or whoever people are right, though, ultimately, at least until now, that then people just get retrained in something else, and then you learn how to use the machines, or you learn how to, you know, do some newer technique, right?
Well, the problem with that is that even if that's the case, then even if you do go work in the factory, you're still sort of immiserated in a new way. Like, you're giving up your control, you're giving up your way of life, you're giving up a mode of work that was cherished for centuries. So, and the Luddites, as I alluded to earlier, they were as much against the factory and this mode of work, where instead of being at home, having control over your labor process, having control over when you got to work, as long, what mattered is you got the garment done and you did a quality job. You didn't have someone breathing down your neck telling you when you could take a piss, when you could, you know, talk to your wife, when you could go walk in the garden.
So they were objecting to the scale at which things were happening, right? So instead of being in your small plot of land growing your vegetables and selling them to people, whatever, now you're working for Big Agra. Instead of making a piece of cloth or a dress, now you're sewing on a factory floor in a you know, whatever they're called. I was gonna say sweat lodge, but
and you're not making as much money a lot of times. Eventually wages do necessarily go up and everything, but so one of the big arguments is that that I'm making and is sort of in contra to a lot of sort of like the Schumpeter types and the sort of the Cato Institute folks today, who, you know, are so free market, is that not only is this sort of an immediate problem for the people who are, you know, experiencing this disruption, and they don't really dispute that ever. So I think we should spend a beat longer. Like, this is a really miserable process that can last decades. So yeah, on net, if you look at the, you know, macroeconomic balance sheet, yeah, it does even out again. Ultimately, more jobs are made as more demand is created and more products come off the assembly line. But in that period, there's no reason that we, as an ingenious human species, need to allow sort of mass suffering to take place in those decades in between.
Right.
That's number one. So you see that today when people are like, oh, you know, well, if you lose your job, you'll find a new one. Yeah. For a lot of people, like, your job is your life. You lose that, you're not coming back. You're not.
Exactly.
You're never going to feel the same.
It feels like you're the conservative, but, you know, it's like I had my mind changed about a lot of this when I was speaking with coal workers, and during the original Trump-Clinton election, speaking to coal workers in Pennsylvania who were like, Hillary Clinton wants to shut down our coal mines and make us work on solar panels for the Chinese. And I always understood it from the AOC perspective of Green New Deal and this is green energy and all that. But I was like, oh, I get it. You're standing on the value that your parents and your grandparents dug out of the ground. And here I am, some little white Jewish lefty telling you, you're polluting my world. Don't you do coal? It's bad for your lungs. Use silicon, you know?
Yeah.
But it's disconnected. So even on a spiritual level, it's like, what the fuck? You're ungrounding me. You're unmooring me from what I know.
Yeah, exactly. And that gets directly into the second point that I would make against that creative destruction argument, which is that calculation changes when you put the decision-making power into the workers' hands themselves. So this is all this is facilitated, this first go-round at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. All of this discontent is because people with resources and with the capital are saying, this is how things are going to be now. This is the way technology is going to be used now. You can either get on board and come work in my factory, or you can go hungry. And that's not an exaggeration. And
yeah, but this was like Dickens' time. The little people in the streets, the little coal soot children, just like Oliver, right? This is Oliver. You've got no power. You're just boys in a workhouse, you know?
Oliver was based on somebody who lived during the Luddite struggle, by the way, and he is Oliver Twist.
Right.
He's a character that I follow, Robert Blinko, that I write about a little bit in the book, who was shipped off to one of these factories. He was an orphan, and he was basically put into indentured servitude, and he, you know, just suffers. He sees the factory system firsthand, and he suffers no great, you know, just no end of great suffering throughout his tenure there. And when he finally gets out, he tells his story to a child labor abolitionist who eventually gets it into print, and it's one of the catalyzing sort of moments to end that kind of child labor. Anyways, he is like a sympathetic figure. Him and his peers, you know, the Luddites and the cloth workers, saw what was happening to them, and they said, you know, that's everybody next. Like, a lot of them wanted to stop the child labor as well, but it was also like a portent for what was happening. So they didn't really have any real political power, but that was the problem. And I think that's what's applicable today. Like when you're talking about the coal workers, like if it's like, I think most people agree that you do have to find a way to wind down coal emissions and carbon emissions. And so how do you do that other than just showing up and saying what you're doing is bad? You have to stop. Yeah. Here's a new job. It's in a solar factory where, again,
right,
it's a completely different set of norms and standard. Yep.
To people, they're going to go MAGA, anti-Soros, anti-Semite, globalist, panic.
Because the Luddites had a word for it, and it was they hated to stand at their command, being told what to do. Nobody likes it. Nobody likes it. I don't like it. I'm sure you don't like it. No one wants to stand it and have an overseer tell them what. So imagine sort of, you know, approaching that for the first time. So a lot of these guys, a lot of the cloth workers who had grown up in, you know, doing the trade plied by their fathers and grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers and great-great-great-great 200 years. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, no, now you don't get to say how you do things anymore. You go work in that windowless building. You breathe in like the fibers from the clothing that's getting churned out by the machine. You can take a bathroom break when I tell you. You can, you know, you're here 10 hours a day, every day, and, you know, you don't get to, you know, you don't get to sing songs in your house anymore.
You're working by the hour instead of working by the product or the production.
Yeah, you're selling your – and imagine – just that, imagine just being told that that's the reality for the first time. Before that, you had any real concrete idea that this was to be normal, that this was going to be inculcated into sort of, you would go, no, you'd go, hell no. Like this is, you might take up a hammer against
it. The only people who behaved, who were treated like that previously were slaves, enslaved people. You know, this hour is no longer yours. This hour is mine. That's soul killing. I mean, it's essentially soul killing.
Yeah. And so that's as much, again, as the machines, they were fighting against that, and the Luddites lost, and they did not lose. Another common misconception is that they lost because they were just fighting against technologies and products that everybody wanted. So it was the market. No, they lost because the state marshaled tens of thousands of troops to crush them. They
generally works.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really, when you're a bunch of, you know, weavers and knitters and you're, you know, and cloth finishers, and then suddenly you're up against the largest, what became the largest single domestic occupation of England, with tens of thousands of troops stationed in industrial districts. It's eventually you're just going to lose.
God, what does this look like? Are these like red coats? Is it that period?
Sometimes they would just march them and they'd make a big show about it in the beginning. But as a sort of a little example of just how, you know, how hated sort of the authority was at the time, they marched those red coats right into Leeds to make a big public show. But they almost got the crowds revolted. The cloth workers sort of started a riot and almost
Molotov
chased
cocktails
them out.
And they whatever said, little muskets or stuff. I mean,
yeah. Well, they had, you know, they had pikes. They did right. have they had guns. They had the blunderbuss. They had they almost chased them out. So they said, okay, let's not do that anymore.
Right.
Let's just kind of quietly set up the garrisons out by the factory. So you could literally kind of interpret it as these battle lines are drawn right where industrialization is happening, where industrialization is unfolding. So you have like real, you know, war zones sort of set up at the front lines of industrialization. And this, you know, that sometimes that culminates in a riot where a bunch of Luddites are killed. Sometimes it means that the Luddites are turned away. There's a famous at least in the sort of the story of the Luddites, and there's the famous battle at Rawfold's Mill, which is sort of the Luddites really try to take on one of these huge factories that's been fortified and has mercenaries, and the soldiers are stationed nearby, and over 100 Luddites kind of attack it, and they didn't know that it had been fortified this way inside, where it was made to be a fortress. They had like gun slots and they were ready to pour boiling tar on them, and they just get gunned down and turned away, and it's kind of the most humiliating defeat for the Luddites. And then over the next few months, the authorities track down anybody who is involved in it, and they end up hanging dozens of the Luddites who participated either there or in this other machine breaking. And that's the culmination.
Right.
I also gotta reiterate that it began as this very sort of strategic, almost like gentle. Like they would warn the factory owner, take down your automating machines.
Yeah.
If you don't, you'll get a visit from Ned Ludd's army. And then if they didn't, they would kind of, yes, they might hold them up by gunpoint, or they might sneak in through a window, and they'd break just the automating machinery. They'd just break
right.
that. Everything else, all the old machines, all the old tools, everything else they might have in the factory, they'd leave and they'd say, keep it down. If you don't bring them back, then you'll be fine. If you do, we'll come back and
right.
we'll do the whole place. So it was really very tactical in the beginning, but as sort of tensions mounted and the troops got called in and things got more dire, it became a, you know, the parliament, instead of, you know, passing a minimum wage or sending any assistance to the cloth workers, they decided to make it a crime punishable by death to smash a machine. And that a lot of these legacies are imprinted sort of at this point most forcefully, that live on forever, that, you know, capital equipment is to be valued over workers' lives. That if you, you know, if you have a grievance, even if it's not being addressed, you have to sit down and be quiet, and sort of industrial might is to be preference over that. It really sort of set a lot of
right.
precedence about where this.
Yeah.
yeah,
and you look today. I mean, not to flash forward in too jolting a fashion, but
no, sure.
even today, you know, many ethical labor and political activists will say, "Well, to attack the network." Is, you know, if you were actually going to attack the internet itself or attack Google itself, that is sort of forbidden. That is a forbidden crime. That's unethical.
Yeah.
You know, a DDoS attack or,
yeah.
I mean, the workers, the Uber workers, for example, don't and can't yeah. organize in the same way
yeah.
that the Luddites did, or
yeah.
Google workers. I mean, they kind of do. They get mad and they won't make a war machine, or they've pushed back a bit. But in the grand scheme of things, I mean, maybe SAG and the WGA, they think they're fighting against AI, kind of.
Yeah. I think that's probably the clearest parallel, is that at least in, you know, so first of all, we're not going to see the same level of sort of industrial sabotage yet, just if by virtue of the fact that we have at least some nominal, you know, democratic channels and available to workers. You could form a union, you can agitate, you know, this England was not a democracy. England had outlawed unions. So both of those were off the table, and then times got so tough. So they did have their back against the wall, and Luddism was a tactic of last resort. That said, I think the spirit of Luddism can inform some of the sort of the tactics that are being adopted today. And I think SAG is the biggest one in that they singled out a technology that studios were hoping to use to exploit their labor, and they said no. So instead of it, it's something we don't see a ton of these days, or we haven't until recently, where it's like, you can't, no, you cannot use that. The answer is no. It's going in our contract that that if anyone's going to decide how to use AI, it's us. You don't get to use it to make scripts, bar none. No. And the fact that they won that fight is pretty encouraging. I mean, there's still a lot of issues, and there were, it's still going to be a rear guard action in a lot of ways, but that to me is sort of a modern iteration of Luddism in rejecting that. But you are right, like, it is so much harder, or at least it was for the last 10 years while the halo of Silicon Valley was kind of fading and people sort of, it was so diffuse and there were some bad things happening, but it was a little more difficult to sort of pinpoint exactly where. But yeah, I mentioned in the book that one of the ingenious and troubling parts of sort of this like late stage technologized capitalism, whatever you want to call it, is that it has distributed sort of those targets and capital equipment among everyone. So when for instance Uber moves into France, where there's very sort of a more powerful taxi guild, and they want to protest it, you can't just go to the Uber boss's house where there's a big, you know, right, Uber, and smash his machine that's generating Uber. You turn on each other. They turned on people who were using their own cars to drive Uber, and they smashed them in the streets. So it was a really sad sort of example of just how contorted this has all become. I do think another place where a lot of sort of the spirit of Luddism is alive is that we are now seeing a correct, in many cases, sort of more vociferous criticism of the tech titans directly. Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk are no longer sort of regarded as, you know, Iron Men. They are, you know, in a lot of people's eyes, they're very villainous. Yeah. And in others, it's more complex.
I know, honestly, the logic behind my own book, Survival of the Richest, and sort of exposing this one group, I don't even know if they're typical, but, you know, this one group of billionaires who are looking to escape, you know, was to sort of expose them on a level. It's like, look, they don't even intend to stay here. You know, it was, yeah. It was like, can that open the discussion that they're not operating with goodwill? You know, and it, yeah. You know, so that was good to sort of open up this, you know, their whole transhuman, you know, Tescreal, you know, escape plan or their effective altruism.
Yeah, that's a great example. That was a great book. And the point was, I think you're exactly right. You're exactly right. It's just that they have such little interest, and just like the tech titans of 200 years ago, in sort of conducting them in a way that would benefit the communities. And the whole sort of framework of that book just opens that blows it wide open. And I think that's the majority, at least, have those inclinations. Maybe not all of them are building the survival bunkers, but sometimes it feels like it's all of them.
They may as well be. I mean, they may as well be. But there was a period, it's funny, when I was coming up in the 80s and early 90s, there was this guy, Chris Carlson, who had a magazine called Processed World that we loved, because like computers were coming into the places where we worked. And it was like, here, take a magnet and rub it on top of that hard drive, and it's going to make your boss really upset. You know, all these little things that we could do. But that was like early sabotage of the processed world that we were moving into.
Yeah. Yeah. I met Chris on the book tour. It was one of the delightful moments. He came out to a reading, and just a really, really, really great guy, it seems. And Process World was a real inspiration. I have, you can still get them on eBay, some of like the collected volumes of their old magazines. Cause they, just like the Luddites, you know, I feel like we're right about a lot of things. They were right about a lot of things, you know, 50 years ago or 30 or 40 years ago. And the landscape has accelerated in some ways. We're dealing with more instantiations of these things, but the same underlying principle, I think, is correct. And there's that Gidget Digits article about sabotage, where she's like, it's kind of a just asking questions, but what if we engaged in a little bit more sort of office destruction of like machinery, little things, you know, which was also sort of manifested in cultural products like, you know, Office Space, the famous smashing
wrong. It feels wrong, right? A DDoS attack feels wrong because it screws up. I mean, you know what? I do understand the idea that an attack on the network is an attack on society, that it's not just an attack on the bad guys. But I mean, and the SAG thing fills me with some hope, although I have a different view of the whole strike. I think was more about Netflix and other streamers trying to reduce the amount of productions they had under contract. They overbought and needed a way to sell, so they create a strike for 90 days, and then they force majeure their way out of contracts. I mean, that two of mine, two of my options, you know, got killed that way. So I understand that technique as well, but you see hope in the future of our relationship to these technologies.
Yeah, I see hope in the way that more people are asserting their right to have a say in how these technologies are developed and deployed, right? Like, I think for too long, we kind of just let Silicon Valley punch the ticket and do what it wanted, and without necessarily kind of realizing that, you know, what they're doing is creating a series of social contracts with us on a lot of these products that they're making, and we're allowing them to dictate the terms of that. We're allowing them to build Facebook and to say, like, this is the terms and conditions of how you use this. Yeah. We're gonna give you Uber. If you want to drive and do gig work, you have to do it on our terms. And I think people are kind of getting fed up with that one-sidedness, or Amazon warehouses. Generative AI, I think, is maybe the straw that broke the camel's back, because it, to so many people, especially in creative professions, it just seems so invasive and exploitative and existentially threatening to them that it's finally too much to bear. That, wait a minute, you just ingested my work that I, you know, I'm trying to make a living off of into your system. Now somebody can hit a button and spit it out and replicate it while getting around copyright concerns, and just sort of use that in their presentation instead of paying me. I think to a lot of people, that feels like a kind of a clarifying moment where it just feels so much more exploitative. You know, writer strike, same thing. You're going to auto-generate this text. They may understand or see that it sucks, but they also feel sort of innately, and that they weren't even asked, right? That's the biggest thing. I feel like tech has gotten the biggest movers and shakers in tech and in Silicon Valley have gotten so used to just doing and not asking, assuming that it's just this one way street, that they just get to do what they want without there being any sort of democratic inputs necessary. But we understand now that this is a social issue, that this is a society wide a problem that we need to sort of assert more control over. It shouldn't just be a handful of white guys in Silicon Valley determining how we use technology, or who gets to use technology, who gets to benefit from technology, who it serves.
Right. So, but we don't even have a working government to help decide that sort of thing. We can't even, you know, we can't even implement a bipartisan border control solution, much less a future of labor under AI solution.
Oh, no. Yeah, no. I mean, it's, don't get me wrong. It's still extremely grim. It's still extremely dark out there. But you know, like last year, we had a huge movement of new sort of labor organizing. We had a lot of victories that might have been unthinkable even, you know, 5 years ago or so. They may seem few and far between, and we're still not at sort of the union density we need to be at, but organized labor is one of the best ways of sort of negotiating right. those sort of social contracts with technology that we have.
But it does seem to me that, I mean, industrial agriculture aside, because, you know, agriculture reduces labor at the cost of topsoil and the environment. I mean, it turns out agriculture is more labor intensive than we are admitting, because you got to do things smaller to keep things alive. But yeah. that aside, and assuming we can, you know, put a few more million people on farming to do it in a permacultural way, it feels like a lot of these technologies are going to replace human labor, and that's not necessarily bad. You know, you're going to lay bricks to build a building. You know, it's like, yes, the master mason might move the cement in some beautiful way, but it's possible that robots could lay the bricks really well and get that look of a hand-laid brick building. And the only problem then is, okay, so if we only need 50% of the human labor that we needed before, why is that a problem? I did this thing a few months ago with Jake Tapper about AI, and he's like, well, what about the unemployment problem? And I said, well, what about the unemployment solution? I don't want yeah. a job. I want stuff, you know?
Yeah, so I'll say the two things to that is like, yeah, so if the trend is that way, if you got the robotic bricklayer and it's going to reduce the labor that the worker can have, how do we give how do we give the bricklayer unions some input into the transition?
Right.
How do you give them the option? Because what you're probably going to get is, okay, so you got an older bricklayer who's been doing it for, you know, 30 years, maybe ready to retire. Maybe if you allow them to have a say into the democratic process of developing technology, then maybe they say, you know what, I'm out. I'll take a buyout. Maybe somebody is just like, hard bricklayer. I want to keep laying bricks till the day I die. By and large, you're going to see some attrition probably, and you can yeah. have a much
but
more.
What if they're just the worker owners of the bricklaying co-op? They keep their shares. The robots do the bricks, and then they give the shares to their kids and their grandkids.
Great.
And you have a whole legacy. How do you
Wonderful.
Get to live and drive around and do all these things without working? Oh, my great grandfather was a bricklayer.
Yes, 100%. That's another option.
I'm happy
option.
With
like,
that
what?
One.
Me too.
So make that.
Yes, make that. But again, we gotta find ways. That's perfect. That would be fun. But again, that only results from empowering workers to be able to make that call in the first place, to be building
right.
up those co-ops, being able to have that say. So most workers are not in any way, positioned to make a call like that, or to be able to enjoy an outcome like that.
Unless they're in the Mondragon, one of those co-ops or something.
We need more stuff like that. I mean, I think it's a real challenge, but like I think like the driver app co-ops that compete with Uber are really interesting, because you can also make them cheaper for Uber's taking like 50% or
right.
more after every ride. You don't need that.
No.
If you have
the good libertarian competition, it turns out the worker owned one can do it cheaper than the corporate owned one, because you don't have to pay all those fucking shareholders. Oh,
that's right.
So let's
you get
win.
You get a couple web devs to like build your app, and then you have a localized, you know, I would love to see more stuff like that.
Yeah, but they'll regulate us is the problem. The Ubers and the wealthy ones have a seat at the regulation table, and we'll figure out a way to make it so our little worker-owned ones can't compete.
Yeah, well, that's a struggle. That's a struggle for sure. And
right,
you know,
so it's not, yeah. I mean, to be clear, it's not the technology.
Yes,
it's almost never the technology. It's not the weaving looms. It's not the Uber thing. It's the business models
yes.
that run the things.
Absolutely. I mean, Uber is just a GPS and a web interface. Like, it's not.
And it's a GPS and Venmo, basically.
Yeah.
You know? And maybe a dating app, you know?
Yeah, they're not curing polio. They're not, like, inventing nuclear fusion. It's a really simple simple web app that really just got at the heart of an idea that sort of they were able to kind of do some labor arbitrage.
Yes.
And they were able to get some venture capital to thrust them into new markets. That's it. It was not the technology. It's the idea. Again, it's the construct and the way that it's being used. It's the social context. And that's, you know, that's what it all comes down to. And that's what we, again, have to assert ourselves in more. I know it's grim out there and I know it's hard. And it does feel like a losing battle sometimes, but there's nothing determined about the technology or the development of technology itself. We can adapt it to these social contexts that we want it to be adapted to.
Right. And it's odd though that we as tech writers, I mean, I was dragged into it when the AOL Time Warner merger is what dragged me into thinking about like economics. And I was a tech guy, video games, media, you know, but you know, we got dragged into this. It's like us and then like these laboring people, like, you know, Astra Taylor and Tom Gokey and, you know, the those guys, it's like are talking about, it's a weird marriage of intellectual tribes trying to solve this kind of future of work problem now.
Yeah. And it, you know, and I think the tent is just getting bigger and bigger. And that's another source of hope, is that now after sort of those the hype campaigns and the do no evils and the, you know, people still love Apple, I guess. But we can see now what the net effect has been for a lot of these technologies, and that's to accelerate inequalities and to concentrate power in the hands of a few tech monopolies. And most people don't like that. That's why one of these few bipartisan issues, I mean, it's not like we really have the votes to get anything serious done right now, or, you know, that there's not a lot of hope in the near future for serious legislative responses. But it is telling that you have people like Josh Hawley decrying big tech on one side and Bernie Sanders decrying big tech on one side, and this whole sort of teeming voice of discomfort with what's going on. It's more visceral than it has been before.
I know, but you also got, you know, like Alex Jones and Steve Bannon reading from the same out loud from some of my books on their shows, you know, talking about, you know, the George Soros global technocracy, you know, they're one third correct in what they're saying,
as it often goes. Donald Trump posted one of my articles to Truth Social last year.
There you go. Mazel tov.
Exactly. And it's like, okay, well, you know, there's something bouncing around in there that I feel like is correct. I don't have a lot of hope that it can be, like, you know, harnessed towards any productive policy solution, but it should give us like a little bit of hope that the animosity is out there. It can be tapped into, you know, not everybody. And you could even argue, maybe optimistically, that most of Steve Bannon's listeners are not as mind melted as he is, and that have some genuine, you know, real concerns that can be addressed. Or perhaps it's just, I feel like there are ways to sort of dig into this dialogue that we can sort of grind out some real paths forward. I don't know. Maybe I'm just an eternal. Even after writing this book, people assume that I'm that I'm just like, oh, Brian Merchant just thinks that that, you know, is a doomer, and that tech's just going to destroy us all, and we're doomed to like sort of another Luddite campaign in vain. But no, like I do see like a sliver. It's like a warped, you know, path through a funhouse mirror.
Yeah.
But we can get there.
I mean, the hope in your work is there's the continuity of the human struggle through it, you know, which is sort of the team human thing, but
that's
even
right.
From a slightly more desperate place, maybe, because you're observing humans in desperate times. But the spirit, human soul, our ability to forge solidarity against all odds, you know, in order to preserve what it means to be human in increasingly exploitative and technologically mediated climates.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think there's nothing more team human than that early Luddite struggle, because, you know, they were also, to them, it felt like a lot like it's felt to us for the last 5 or 10 years, where AI and sort of all this emphasis on these sort of technological vessels that are going to bring about some unrecognizable modernity. That's the pundit class, and the Silicon Valley keeps sort of, you know, pushing that vision. Back then, it was not so different. They had what they called the machinery question, where they're debating sort of whether or not machinery is going to be taken over, is going to be used to take over sort of their world. And yes, there's like some issues of pastoralism. Is it going to like take over the countryside? Is it going to sort of, you know, cause pollution and sort of crowd out? But they had a lot of these same concerns even then. Like, are we going to lose our agency to the machine and the people that own them? Or is it going to sort of take over not just our jobs, but our very humanity? And so the Luddite struggle was an answer to that question, right, in favor of Team Human. They were saying, you know what, like, technology that is hurtful to commonality is what we should oppose. Technology that's hurtful to commonality, stuff that is going to hurt more people than it's going to help, we have to make sure we fight that stuff and embrace what we know can be used for the communal benefit. So that at the core, I think, speaks to what the Luddites' mission was. And it was absolutely, a sort of this mass vote in favor of Team Human.
Right. But it requires a post-individualist model of the world. You know, it's not what can I get out of this? It's how are we going to be affected by this? And you got to understand it in terms of your neighborhood and your community and your fellow workers.
Yeah, and that's one reason that they were able to be so powerful and so sort of such a fearsome force. They had these immense bonds of solidarity, because you grew up in a weaving town. You guess what? You knew everybody, and everybody was in the same boat as you if times were tough, and times got really tough. And you weren't just thinking about your own bottom line, your farm. You're thinking about your neighbor who can't feed his kids. You're thinking about the merchant who is resisting technology to his own detriment. You're thinking about these things that are affecting the entire communal bonds that hold your neighborhood together. So yeah, it's absolutely that, and that sort of was the underpinning of the Luddite struggle. And you know, it was really remarkable. Like, they would put huge bounties up for Luddites. If anyone with information about who burned down the factory last weekend, here's like as much money as you'll make in 10 years. No one would come forward, because there was just so much solidarity in these communities and so much support for what they were doing, and a little, you know, fear about the blowback too, sure. But it was time and time again, they would get nobody. They would have to pay some informers to try to infiltrate the groups, and they couldn't really do that again because the solidarity was so strong between these brotherhoods of workers and people.
Now they'll just hack our Gmail accounts and
they'll try.
See, yeah, everything. So are you still doing your sci-fi? Are you doing Terraform? Is that still around?
Terraform went on hiatus when Vice went bankrupt. So maybe if they
went bankrupt? See, I'm not following up with anything. Are they around?
They still are publishing.
They're just bankrupt, but publishing. Okay.
They
like any of us.
Yeah, they lost a lot of people. They
were kind of shitty in some ways, though. You know, I mean, everyone's shitty in some ways is, you know, what it comes down to. I mean, any of these companies, and if they don't start out shitty, they kind of get shitty. It's enshittification, as Corey would say, enshittification writ large. You have to enshittify to stay alive, unless you establish genuinely great horizontal labor relations.
Yeah. No, I mean, Vice was from a managerial perspective, it was a nightmare. I was involved in the union drive what feels like a billion years ago there, because they were paying people, you know, less than $30,000 to live in New York City, while Shane Smith went around and talked about how it was fine because all of his employees were Trustafarians, and everyone was like, well, excuse me? So organizing advice gave me such a skewed view of labor organizing could be, because we went, does anyone think we should form a union here, and like, you know, 90 hands shoot up in a room like nearly unanimous. It was so easy because everybody was so ground out there.
So what's next for you then? Or is it too early to think? You've only been released from the Times for like 6 days or something. But what are you thinking? I mean, it's so hard. I'm lucky because, you know, in 2007, during that mortgage crisis crash, I went and got a PhD because I was thinking, shit, this publishing thing may not, you know, I mean, I'm writing more important books, but they're kind of not selling the same way they did back in the 90s. The book industry changed, you know, with everybody on LinkedIn publishing their own book. So it was it's just a little different. And that's sort of, so that's my health insurance. That's like my nut is teaching now. But what are you thinking?
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a great question. So this is the second or third, depending on how you count it, job that has kind of gone up in a chuff of smoke amid mass layoffs, because it happened at Medium too. When they cut all of Medium's editorial staff, they kept on some writers, but they got rid of the staff editorial.
They all scatter to Fast Company, The Atlantic, Inside. I mean, LA Times. Still know them all. Yeah, LA Times. Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it's, am I going to keep doing that? I got two kids. Am I going to keep doing this? Am I going to, like, you know, economically, like, I'm lucky that I'm okay, but it's, again, I have been working my ass off for the last 20 years. I've been publishing books. I've been, you know, getting into the speaking game a little bit. So, you know, it can feel like a hamster wheel. It may be time to sort of, consider consider teaching. I have healthcare and all that. My wife is an academic. She teaches at LMU, I'm fortunately covered there too. But you know, I don't know. I might look into researching AI. I'll probably just like hem and haw for another week or two, and then just go find more journalism jobs to, you know, because it's what I do.
I always do that. I poke around. It's like, all right, another book. God damn it. I'll do what I do.
I've always done it. I got another, I'm on contract for another book, so I have another book to write. I guess I probably can't discuss that one yet. It's
but
not
that's
quite,
great another book. It means the world will get another book yet still.
Well, thank you. It means I also have to write it, so there's always that process.
It's way less fun than it looks like.
It's like, it can be like very fun for like one day and then miserable for like 10 days. It's always a process for sure. It'll be fine. I'm sure I'll find, I've had so many wonderful people reach out to me, and I'll just use this as an opportunity to thank all them, who've people from all different magazines and institutes and who are interested in working with me. And it was nice to people really liked this column. I feel like I was lucky to have an editor who was not afraid to publish it, because it was, we could get pretty aggressive on some of this stuff, and it was great to really have a venue to sort of do some real, you know, accountability, real sort of take labor side in the tech debate, and which doesn't often get shared. And we published some great, my editor was let go too. So I'm sure he'll find something great too.
I guess I'll see you on Substack with everyone.
I would be lying if I didn't say I wasn't considering it. So.
Yeah, it's not so bad. It's not so bad. Although now there's supposedly Nazis there, and I got to watch out for them. And it's like, I just got myself set up there. Now I got to leave because of Nazis. I'll see.
Nazis, man.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere. All right. Well, thanks, Brian. Thanks for the book. It was very encouraging. Blood in the Machine, The Origins of the Rebellion Against Big Tech. You know, now, because I'm in whatever the opposite of the origins are, is where I am.
The end phase.
The end phase. Yeah. The last stand, or the digital Alamo. But we'll see. We'll be fine. Humans will be fine somehow. We'll figure it out.
Well, humans just gotta keep fighting. Well, this was great fun. I'm a fan of the pod. I've enjoyed your work for who knows how long now. So
thanks, and it was inspirational to see this thing in the LA Times for this long, because it's like the only other places you see it would be like, you know, on Paris Marx's Substack or something, right?
But
the fact that it was acknowledged by a major, you know what I mean? And it's something, you know, Cleveland Plain Dealer or larger is, you know, mainstream to me.
It was nice. It was good while it lasted.
Yeah. And we're still here to tell the tale.
That's right.
All right. Cheers. Thanks, man.
Yeah. Cheers.
And thank you for being on Team Human. You can find out more about Brian Merchant at his website, brianmerchant.org, or check out the links to his work in our show notes. One way you can join in the fight for human autonomy in an age of machines is to go to teamhuman.fm and click on support. Become a supporting member of the team, get access to our Discord, free access to live events, all sorts of great stuff. Team Human is produced by Joshua Chapdelaine and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.